And we will be on time the next time we next speaker. When the predictions came on,
you need the mic, yeah.
The search for the helium-3 superfluidity began, but the technology and the low-temperature instruments were not there yet. David Lee, and there was a lot of competition, both experimental and, as you saw, theoretical. David Lee, who is our next speaker, and who is credited with the discovery of the superfluidity in helium-3, together with Usherov and Richardson, is going to be talking about those early days of superfluidity in helium-3. I still can't get used to the latex notation. Experimentalists, you.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here, and thank you for inviting me. I listened with wonderment to the previous talks and was really enjoyed them, and Joe's talk in particular was very helpful because I have a plethora of slides and a minimum of time, so some of the overlap was really helpful in this regard. So I just wanted to, first of all, before really starting, I wanted to give enormous credit to my co-workers, Bob Richardson and Doug Usherov. They did a fantastic job, and they were wonderful colleagues to have. We appreciated and enjoyed the collaboration of the Cornell Theory Group and all the visitors and friends who came by. And we got a lot of help in the experiments by Willie Gully, who fixed an essential leak, which was totally important for the work. And so there were a lot of people who helped, and we really feel very, very, very grateful to all of them. Also, talking about competition, we had competition in the realm of experimental physics as well, because John Wheatley was a ferocious competitor. And I noticed I was reading a book by Edward Wilson, the famous Harvard entomologist, saying the reason that he had done so well was because he had a very, very famous and gifted competitor. And that was sort of spurred him on to greater, and that was James Watson of Watson and Crick. Anyway, I should move forward. There's a lot to cover. The first thing I wanted to show was, is this working? Yes. This is how helium-3 is made. Bombarding lithium-6 with neutrons in a reactor gives rise to tritium and helium-4. You separate the helium-4 from the tritium by a hot palladium leak. Palladium takes on hydrogen. The hydrogen, being tritium, can diffuse through the palladium tube, come out, and you end up with a mixture, and you end up with the tritium. And the tritium decays to helium-3 with a half-life of 12.5 years. Here we go. Okay, well, we heard a lot about this already, so I should probably go through this fairly quickly. In 1954, Bill Fairbank did a landmark experiment with his group at Duke University. It was a rather large group with many, many helpers, and they did magnetic resonance on liquid helium-3, what small quantities were available. There's a tiny amount of liquid helium-3, and they were able to measure susceptibility, and they saw the strong deviations from the ordinary Boltzmann statistics as the susceptibility deviated quite strongly and entered the Pauli paramagnetic state. However, the susceptibility was much, much higher than had been anticipated, and that will be of importance, and it was certainly related to Joe Serene's talk on the spin fluctuations. The specific heat is another thing that was measured. Anderson, Reese, Wheatley, and our host, George Zimmerman and Myron Strong and Henry Fairbank measured the specific heat. All these things led to existence and knowledge of a linear specific heat. And however, terms were seen in the, I better get out of the way, terms we're seeing, there was a linear term, and then there was this BT cubed log T, which has now been associated, which has been associated by Joe Serene with a paramagnon correction. Also, Rahm et al. And Horst Meyer's group at Duke, much later, saw an AT squared term in the susceptibility, a minus AT squared term in the susceptibility, which also signified the existence of paramagnons. So we have two pieces of evidence for paramagnons, even in the very early work. Okay, come on. Okay, oh, that's the blank one. That is a slide that doesn't say anything. The next slide, we discuss, yes, so I won't say anything. We discuss transport measurements. This is the early, what this work was, just to show that Fermi-Dirac statistics played a role, and the mean collision time being 1 over T squared for Fermi gas, and so you the liquid here is exhibiting Fermi gas behavior, but there are deviations as far as the numbers are concerned. Okay, the viscosity, viscosity showed a T to the minus 2 dependence because of this tau. The thermal conductivity, because of the specific heat, was linear, but the tau was 1 over T squared. The thermal conductivity was shown to be 1 over T. Anderson and Reese and Wheatley proved this conclusively. We got down to the minimum somewhat earlier, but we never were able to cool further. That was very hard competing with Wheatley, must say. And Howie Hart and John Wheatley also did the spin diffusion measurements, and they also exhibited the T to the minus 2 dependence. The sound velocity was measured. It was quite a bit faster than had been expected to for a Fermi gas of the density of helium 3. Okay. And Landau came along with this theory. Joe Serene mentioned a lot of this, and here's the expansion he referred to with the D is the density of states, and here we have the two expansions, the symmetric and spin symmetric and anti-symmetric expansions. And over the years following this, publication and acceptance of the Landau theory, the main effort, experimental effort, was to actually find these F parameters, F1A, F0A, and various experiments led to various values for these parameters. And specific heat was 1 plus F1S over 3, and here you have the velocity of sound. Sorry about the same symbol. The velocity of ordinary sound was equal to the velocity squared in the ideal gas. IG means ideal gas. And there are two Fermi liquid parameters involved there. And the susceptibility, and this is particularly important, was chi was equal to chi of the ideal gas divided by 1 plus F naught A to the minus 1. But F naught A was about minus 0.7. Joe just told us it was minus 0.76. It varied some with pressure. But this was this gave you, because of this thing being in the denominator, it gave you an exceptionally large susceptibility. And finally, the spin diffusion, it gave you another measure of F naught A. Well, during that time, John Wheatley and his group were very productive, and the rest of us kind of fell by the wayside. And in my own case, we went into helium 3-4 mixtures, and we did some work in solid helium 3, and we got interested in the solid, which was. Oh, by the way, I remarked that this F naught A, being minus 0.7, made the helium 3 look almost ferromagnetic. Well, never quite made it. It would have been rather interesting if it had. Okay? And now, there's a mistake here, by the way. The Landau theory predicted a new phenomenon. Any theory, any good theory, or many good theories, I should say, they usually explain something you already know, but if they can predict something new, all the better. And this one predicted, Landau's theory predicted a new mode of sound, which he called zero sound, collisionless sound, and they gave rise to compressional waves, and you also have shear waves now, that could propagate via the quasi-particle interactions. This word parameter is wrong, it's a typo. Sorry about that. And what Landau did is he set up a Boltzmann transport equation and set the right-hand side, the collision integral, equal to zero, and he was able to come up with this relationship between the values of zero sound squared minus the values of first sound squared divided by first sound squared, and it got 4/5 1 over 1 plus F0. And that's an approximation, which turns out to be quite good for helium-3. Okay. And this is Wheatley's data. Again, I mean, this is the kind of competition that existed, and we were sort of fighting for air, so to speak, up on the top of Mount Everest. And here we have a here's what happens. As you lower the temperature, the attenuation of sound increases and increases and increases because collisions become more and more rare as you go, as the fuzz on the Fermi surface gets thinner and thinner. And finally, though, you get into the collisionless regime. The maximum attenuation here is here, but you get into the collisionless regime, and then the attenuation starts falling. There's also a change of a few meters, 5 meters, 6 meters per second in the velocity. So you have the change in velocity occurring in the same general temperature region where this maximum the attenuation occurs. And this is another effect associated with Landau Fermi liquid and Tony Leggett's amazing predictive ability that the spin diffusion also, when you get into the collisionless regime, what happens is the spins, you have to consider yourself in NMR and being in the rotating frame, but the spins also precess in the molecular field associated with the interactions of the helium-3. I hope I'm saying that right. And the prediction, among others, was that the prediction was that the spin diffusion would reach a maximum at higher magnetic fields and then come down. And this the same thing happened here. And at the very low fields, which corresponds to the measurement of Howie Hart and John Wheatley, you just got this. But this measurement was done by Linton Coracini and Doug Osheroff, Bob Richardson, in our group, and it was a very, very beautiful effect, and it confirmed Tony's prediction very, very well. There are other aspects and other parts of this measurement I don't have really time to go into, but it was a very, very beautiful effect and had a lot of implications for other systems. For example, when we studied polarized hydrogen gas, we discovered spin waves, and they were again a product of this type of reasoning. I next want to talk a little bit, since everybody was driven into going into helium-3 for our mixtures. Well, first of all, the phase separation had been discovered earlier by King Walters and Bill Fairbank back in the 50s, a really memorable experiment where the helium-3 and helium-4 phase separation separate at the tri-critical point, which was discovered at Cornell by Earl Graf and John Reppe in our group, the coexistence curve indicate on either side, and in the region in between, it's sort of a forbidden region. There are two phases existing here, and this is the horizontal line crossing this two-phase region. And as you get colder and colder, you eventually reach a point where the helium-4, this is the helium-4-rich phase, still contains 6% helium-3, and this is very important. The right-hand side, you have very, very pure helium-3. So this is one of the purest things you know. Very, very pure. Okay, this made possible the dilution refrigerator, because what happens is if you can come down with your almost pure, perfectly pure helium-3 down to here, you push it down, and then you cross this two-phase region, and then the helium-3 comes into what we call the mixing chamber. You mix it, and then it comes back up the tube, and you can pump it around with a pump, and it just goes around and around. And this horizontal line corresponds to cooling. You got a mixing of helium-3 into the helium-4. The heat of mixing or the heat of demixing, the cooling of mixing gives you a lot of cooling, and this can be a cyclic process, so it goes round and round, and you can be reach very low temperatures like 10 millikelvin, now even 2 millikelvin with a dilution refrigerator. So this was a landmark achievement by first thought of by Heinz London, but later brought to fruition by by the Leiden group, and then Henry Hall perfected it, and then John Wheatley developed better and better heat exchangers. So this was an experimental situation. You now no longer had to rely on the adiabatic demagnetization, which is awkward, and it's a one-shot affair. A dilution refrigerator, you can just go round and round and round. And here's a typical setup. The helium-3 comes in this little thing through the heat exchange. This is where it condenses. It goes through the still. I mean, it's in contact with the still, and goes through a continuous heat exchanger, a bunch of step heat exchangers, comes down here, and then the dilute phase gets pumped up by osmotic pressure going up through here and through the still and out and back up to the pump. It's like making whiskey, I guess, through a still. I like the language. Okay, now, this was a really important development. Another important development took place at Ohio State. Now, the melting curve of helium-3 was thought to have a minimum because you have a the solid has a rather high entropy, R log 2, corresponding to the spins, and the nuclear spins are very, very small, and whereas the liquid has a stronger Fermi liquid loss of entropy due to the linear specific heat and linear entropy. Associated linear entropy. So the entropy of the liquid is dropping fast. The entropy of the solid doesn't change very much in this region. At 3/10 of a degree, you get a minimum of the melting curve. And this work was done by David Edwards and Baum, Doug Brewer, John Daunt, and McWilliams. This is their early melting curve. It's beautiful data. They did it with strain gauges, and it was really, really wonderful. And we were going to work on this, but unfortunately our lab fell into the excavation and so we couldn't do anything, and it took us 2 years to get that fixed. A new building, of course. We built it ourselves. Okay, that was supposed to be a joke. Okay, and as far as cooling the helium-3 is concerned, you can use this to cool helium-3. By the way, I wanted to thank my professor, Henry Fairbank, called my attention to this article by Pomeranchuk. Isaac Pomeranchuk, 1950. A particle theory, you always think of him as being a particle theorist, but he was pretty darn good with thermodynamics, and it was wonderful for us that he thought of this idea. Because if you compress the helium-3 adiabatically, well, here's the entropy curve, and it comes down very rapidly near wherever the solid transition happens to be. And what you can do is you start at some platform like 10 millikelvin, 20 millikelvin is where we started, and you can adiabatically compress the helium-3 to this point, and you just follow this blue line, and that gives you you can cool all the way down to the Nael temperature and maybe below. You have so the melting curve, the slope of the melting curve, by the way, I just would like to discuss the slope of the melting curve for a minute. It's given by the Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which corresponds to the entropy difference divided by the specific volume difference, or in other words, the latent heat divided by the temperature times delta V. And the minimum, as we showed in the curve of Edwards, Daunt, McWilliams, and Brewer, and so on, was at 3.32 degrees. So you want to compress. How do you compress? Well, here you have this big, you have a capillary going up to room temperature. Here you have this thing that plugs up, because you try to exert pressure through the capillary, you hit this block of solid, and you can't compress anymore. So how do you do it? You have to think of some other way of compressing, and you need some kind of a flexible walled container, and you press in on the wall in order to do the compressing, and the block capillary actually helps you there because it keeps the pressure in, so to speak. So at Cornell and many other places, several other places, people were trying to devise a way to do that kind of cooling. So our team, I call it Team Pomeranchuk, you know, it's like NASCAR racing or something like that. And so Doug Osheroff was a wonderful, wonderful graduate student, and we are extremely grateful for his efforts, brilliance, and so on. Bob Richardson was a great colleague. Jim Seitz and Lynn Carcini, his thesis was to do he attached his Leggett-Rice apparatus to the Pomeranchuk cell. and did the work there. Jim Seitz built our first Parmarinchuk cell, and we had a lot of good advice from John Reppy and Willie Gully, as I said before, fixed the leak that saved the day for us. So there's always a lot of people contributed to this work. Unbeknownst to us, Anufriev in Russia, all the way back in 1966, that just shows you have to read all the literature. Well, we were very, very, we were not very much on the ball, and we didn't know about it. But way back in 1965, Anufriev did this experiment and did the Pomeranchuk cooling. He had his helium-3 outside, his helium-4 inside. He pressurized the helium-3 up as high as he could, and then that stressed this diaphragm, and then he raised the pressure on helium-3 in this container. Then the diaphragm bulged out and gave you the requisite 5% volume change which you needed in order to get Pomeranchuk to solidification. Enough, well, you don't really have to get that much, but some small percentage will give you considerable cooling. And he did it, and he cooled down into the tens of millidegrees. His temperature scale was not very good. I don't really understand why he didn't do as well. Kapitsa came to visit us at Cornell at one point, and he said, well, he talked about Anufriev a little, and I don't know, he was a little disappointed. In any case, Jim Seitz's cell looked like this. This is just to show you the way we decided to do it with bellows, flexible silphon bellows with helium-4, and we had some extra way of pressurizing. Originally, we thought about using a weight or a spring. All would have worked. Almost anything works. This thing is a very, very robust technique and gives you huge cooling powers. And John Reppy suggested, why don't you draw, because we were worried about the heating of the bellows. Peshkov, who had discovered second sound originally, said that, well, it'll never work because there's too much heating in the bellows. But then somebody pointed out, well, when you cool lead down below into the liquid nitrogen range, it rings like a bell. So this is telling you that it will have a high Q. So therefore, you don't really need this so much, but in any case, at the time, we wanted very, very thin, floppy bellows in here, and this is the outer helium-4 one, which pressed on this thing. Then you pump the helium-4 out of this intermediate one, and that acted like a hydraulic press. So it worked, but the unfortunate thing, Jim Seitz's experiment only went down to about 2 millikelvin, or even maybe not even that, because what we thought was happening, is that solid helium-3 was getting caught in the convolutions in the bellows. So the next thing that happened was, okay, superconductivity. A lot of these things have already been said, so I'm not going to talk too much about this. This is superconductivity. This is BCS. And the interactions and the superconductivity was associated with S wave and L equals zero, S equals zero, and the spin being zero. Okay, I'm not going to dwell on this one because I'm very short on time here. Okay, so then people and Andy Sessler and Phil Anderson. Joe all talked about the Ln equals zero pair. We have this, but I like this picture of the colors. Unfortunately, the circles got squashed into egg shapes. I don't quite know why when we made this thing. But anyway, this is the attractive region of potential. This is the repulsive region. And the pairs, if they're unequal to zero, you want to have the attractive region be in play as much as possible. So Andy Sessler talked about the D-wave pairing, but Bill Fairbanks' group had shown, as we stated earlier, that the susceptibility was much larger than it should have been. And I don't know exactly the history of laser and Fay, but I think it prompted them to some extent to think that this would give rise to parallel spin pairing and an odd L state. And this was. And Joe had talked about this quite a bit, so I won't go further into that. And then there was the Anderson-Morel state, which came up with the upspins, two downspins and two upspins, just two of the possible spin states. And then the Balian-Werthammer state came along, and that had two downspins, two upspins, two downspins, and the up-down MS equals zero. Well, nobody was really, we in the experimental community were not concentrating very hard on what was going on in liquid helium, because the thing to do was to find the transition in solid helium-3. Phil Anderson, at a talk that I heard, had this wonderful phrase, namely, at this particular period in the late 60s and so on, we were possessed by irrational non-exuberance. And I think that it was very, very true. So therefore, we were mainly involved in thinking about the solid. We didn't really, we said, and some of the theorists, I won't mention who they were, but some of the theorists actually predicted that the temperature was so low that one could never reach it, so without some major new advance. So we said, well, we'll go ahead and do the solid, which is what we did. We thought we did anyway. Okay. I just wanted to give you a couple of these are nice diagrams. This is the Balian-Wertheimer state has an isotropic energy gap, okay, and it consists of all three spin states as shown up here, whereas the Anderson-Morell-Brinkman now state has a node in the gap, and the L vector, which is the vector associated with orbital angular momentum, is actually thought to point along the nodes. Okay. Sorry, wrong one. Okay. So finally, Doug Osheroff got hurt in a skiing accident, and he was confined for a while. And during that time, he designed this beautiful cell, which was the one that was used in all the experiments. It was, again, made use of the hydraulic press principle. Now, we decided a number of us, I guess, felt, and we talked about this a lot together, a lot of us felt you could get away with much, much more robust, stiffer bellows, because already the stress diaphragm seems to work, and nobody worried too much about the heating. So therefore, this setup was actually in the vacuum chamber. This was the helium-4 bellows, which was quite wide, and then this rod, this piston, actually pushed the helium-3 bellows down. In other words, the reason this was effective is because the bellows tended to stretch out, it tended to distend into the main chamber, into the experimental chamber, and therefore you wouldn't catch solid helium-3 in the bellows and crush it and get heating. And this was the first experiment that had a platinum thermometer, which was good down to about 3 millikelvin. And then one of the big things, and Bob Richardson pushed for this pretty hard, let's get a strain gauge in here so we can really have a very, very good idea of what the melting pressure is. And this is this type of strain gauge was designed by Dwight Adams. It's the famous Strady Adams strain gauge, the capacitance gauge, and you connected it to a very sensitive capacitance bridge. Let me just review again. The helium-4 was up here. The helium-3 was down here. The hydraulic press pushed this piston rod down. The bellows and the bellows distended into the chamber, and what you ended up with was a mixture of solid and liquid helium-3 in the chamber. Okay, and this is the famous curve which Joe Serene just showed a minute or two ago. As you cool down, the compression took place at a constant rate, and so this plot is pressure versus time. And what you first saw, what Doug first saw when he saw this, was a subtle change in slope. And then a little further on, there was a sudden drop in pressure. And then up here, it came to you came to the end of the compression capacity. And in all likelihood, but we really didn't know at the time, this was probably where the true solid helium-3 transition was taking place. As you warmed up, there was this little ledge here. And this corresponded, I think, to the latent heat of a first order. The interpretation was it corresponded to the latent heat of a first order phase transition. And then you came down and you had an A prime mirror image of the A, exactly the same. And we pretty well concluded that this had to be some kind of a specific heat maximum. Well, okay, Wheatley, we had the feeling that Wheatley was breathing hot on our tail. We better go public with this thing, even though we didn't really know what it was. So we said, well, we're looking for the solid, and the change in slope looks like a specific heat that could very well be the solid. We were very worried about what was going on up here because this supercooling thing was just too fast to happen in the solid, and we debated about this and tried to downplay in our first publication, PhysRev Letters, what this was because we were kind of, well, we were very concerned about it. We were very concerned about the whole thing. We talked about it and talked about it, said, should we go public? And we went public. Okay, we made a mistake. Oh, how did they say it? So I was wrong. So anyway, it was too bad, but that's what happened. So we published, and people talked to us. And in fact, we gave a 10-minute paper in San Francisco at the APS meeting. And John Goodkind said, oh, what you've got here is superfluid helium-3. And I said, well, John, we're going to do an NMR experiment. And when that's done, we'll have a much better idea of what's going on. So this is the cell, the lower part of the Pomeranchuk cell. The interior of it was replaced by this setup in order to do the NMR experiment. And we had here, the coil was here, and there was a little heater toward the bottom, which actually was useful. And there's the platinum thermometer, NMR thermometer was up here. And again, here's the bellows, which distended down into the chamber, and here's the Strady-Adams strain gauge to measure the pressure. And now, because we were anxious to know which was the liquid and what was going on in the liquid, what was going on in the solid, we decided to do an imaging type of experiment. Bill Fairbank had used this to advantage when he discovered he and King Walters discovered the phase separation. So we thought maybe we could tell what the solid was doing, what the liquid was doing in here. Let me just backtrack a little bit and say that the solid helium-3 has a very large susceptibility because we have so many unpaired spins. We have so many spins which do not, I mean, we have so many spins. What I'm saying is the Fermi liquid, the Fermi Dirac statistics, takes a lot of spins out of circulation. So the susceptibility of the liquid would be expected to be a lot smaller than that of the solid. So this is the way one might hope to differentiate between the presence of liquid and the presence of solid. Okay, so once again, this is the NMR coil here. And this is a field gradient, which was used to establish where the solid or liquid was. And as you swept the field or frequency or whatever you decided to sweep, you could sample various parts of the cell. It was a very crude form of NMR imaging. MRI, they call it nowadays, because they don't like nuclear. But Paul Lauterbur came around to the lab and visited us and liked what he saw, I guess, and went on. He was working on this, and he went on to develop MRI along with Sir Peter Mansfield. And this is, well, one night, Doug called me up at about 3 in the morning and said, guess what? I discovered BCS. And I said, hey, that's great. What happened? And he said, well, the gradient experiment worked right. There was one particular run, which I call the one-sided run. The solid all gathered typically on both sides, but this particular one, the solid seemed to gather only on one side. Notice this solid susceptibility is huge. It goes up to there somewhere, whereas the liquid is very, very small. But you can see that as we cooled down, went through the B transition now, suddenly the liquid susceptibility dropped by a factor of 2. This drop in susceptibility, well, was quite a mystery, but it certainly looked like something exciting was going on. This later, just to make a long story short, was identified with the B phase, which has a reduced susceptibility because of the up-down-down-up spins. Okay, I'm trying to finish, George. Okay. And so the next thing that happened was, let's get rid of that gradient. And Doug actually had put a nail in the magnet, so he took the nail out. Let's get rid of that gradient and see what's going to happen. And we got rid of the gradient. And again, here's the solid signal. And here, and this is the liquid signal is buried inside the solid. And then as you lower as you start going into the A phase, this liquid signal comes out of hiding. And as you lower the temperature, it goes on and on and on, bigger and bigger and bigger. And until eventually you hit the B phase, and then it goes back under the under here, but again, it's smaller because the susceptibility becomes smaller when you go into the B phase, remember, as I said a moment ago. Okay, so this was really exciting. I mean, when you see something like this, you say, wow, this is quantitative, and many other things. This is cool, I guess you say nowadays. All right, and it was pretty cool, temperature-wise. And so we had this, the data was all over the place, and we talked with Bob Silsby and said, well, why don't you try plotting it in terms of the square of the liquid signal minus the square of the solid signal? And to our delight, look what happened. All these curves, all these points fell on a universal curve for all the different fields. We tried it at several different fields, by the way, and several different frequencies. And when it was plotted like this, these things fell on a universal curve. And we call this the Pythagorean relationship. And you can almost say that there had to be, since it's Pythagorean, there has to have been some kind of a perpendicular field. So what's going on here? Well, I'll let Tony address this point. Okay. But in any case, there were in the end, it turned out there were three superfluid phases, the A1 phase, which Doug had observed at Cornell, but later on, working with Phil and Bill Brinkman, I guess, they really nailed the whole thing down. And later on, when you do the ultrasound on this thing, you have two collective modes, one at the A1 transition, one at the A2 transition. And then, I think I'll just skip through here. The B phase is interesting because the spin and the orbital coordinates, there's the weak dipolar interaction caused the spin and the orbital coordinates to be rotated away from one another, and the angle is thought to be 104 degrees. And I'll just quickly show this because I'm about to end. I see George is getting restless, and I will now. The last slide I have to show, this is the main phase diagram, I forgot to say. The phase diagram shows the three different phases. The A phase here, this little sliver phase, it takes very high magnetic fields to really separate this out a lot. We've taken it all the way up to about 8 Tesla or so, and it separates quite a bit up here, but it's quite a narrow phase, and it corresponds to only one spin type of spin pair. A liquid is up, up, and down, down, and then finally you have the B liquid, which occupies most of the phase diagram. This is the Balian-Werthammer, now identified with the Balian-Werthammer state. And this is Tony Leggett's wonderful theory, which I'll let him explain. And this is the thing I wanted to show you, finally, that Doug Ossaroff and Lynn Coracini, when Doug was at Bell Labs, actually did a pulsed NMR experiment and showed that, sure enough, there was no shift in the frequency when you were below 104 degrees. But when you were above 104 degrees, you got this large frequency shift. We did a confirming experiment like this at Cornell, and it's a very beautiful effect. It really comes on very, very suddenly. With that, I think I'll conclude, and thank you for your attention.
I was glad to hear that you changed the field gradient by removing a nail.
You had the subject nailed down.
Of course. Well, this is an experiment, and it's very important that people realize that it all boils down to a few pieces of metal and maybe some other material.